Chapter 6. The Apple II. Dawn of a New Age. An Integrated Package. As Jobs walked the floor of the Personal Computer Festival, he came to the realization that Paul Terrell of the Byte Shop had been right. Personal computers should come in a complete package. The next Apple, he decided, needed to have a great case and a built-in keyboard, and to be integrated end-to-end, from the power supply to the software. "My vision was to create the first fully packaged computer," he recalled. "We were no longer aiming for the handful of hobbyists who liked to assemble their own computers, who knew how to buy transformers and keyboards. For every one of them, there were 1,000 people who would want the machine to be ready to run." In their hotel room on that Labor Day weekend of 1976, Wozniak tinkered with the prototype of the new machine to be named the Apple II that Jobs hoped would take them to this next level. They brought the prototype out only once, late at night, to test it on the color projection television in one of the conference rooms. Wozniak had come up with an ingenious way to goose the machine's chips into creating color, and he wanted to see if it would work on the type of television that uses a projector to display on a movie-like screen. "I figured a projector might have a different color circuitry that would choke on my color method," he recalled. "So I hooked up the Apple II to this projector, and it worked perfectly." As he typed on his keyboard, colorful lines and swirls burst on the screen across the room. The only outsider who saw this first Apple II was the hotel's technician. He said he had looked at all the machines, and this was the one he would be buying. To produce the fully packaged Apple II would require significant capital, so they considered selling the rights to a larger company. Jobs went to Al Alcorn and asked for the chance to pitch it to Atari's management. He set up a meeting with the company's president, Joe Keenan, who was a lot more conservative than Alcorn and Bushnell. "Steve goes in to pitch him, but Joe couldn't stand him," Alcorn recalled. "He didn't appreciate Steve's hygiene." Jobs was barefoot and at one point put his feet up on a desk. "Not only are we not going to buy this thing," Keenan shouted, "but get your feet off my desk." Alcorn recalled thinking, "Oh well, there goes that possibility." In September, Chuck Peddle of the Commodore Computer Company came by the Jobs house to get a demo. We'd opened Steve's garage to the sunlight, and he came in wearing a suit and a cowboy hat, Wozniak recalled. Peddle loved the Apple II, and he arranged a presentation for his top brass a few weeks later at Commodore headquarters. "You might want to buy us for a few $100,000, Jobs said when they got there. Wozniak was stunned by this ridiculous suggestion, but Jobs persisted. The Commodore honchos called a few days later to say they had decided it would be cheaper to build their own machine. Jobs was not upset. He had checked out Commodore and decided that their leadership was sleazy. Wozniak did not rue the lost money, but his engineering sensibilities were offended when the company came out with the Commodore PET 9 months later. "It kind of sickened me. They made a real crappy product by doing it so quick. They could have had Apple." The Commodore flirtation brought to the surface a potential conflict between Jobs and Wozniak. Were they truly equal in what they contributed to Apple and what they should get out of it? Jerry Wozniak, who exalted the value of engineers over mere entrepreneurs and marketers, thought most of the money should be going to his son. He confronted Jobs personally when he came by the Wozniak house. "You don't deserve shit," he told Jobs. "You haven't produced anything." Jobs began to cry, which was not unusual. He had never been and would never be adept at containing his emotions. He told Steve Wozniak that he was willing to call off the partnership. "If we're not 50-50, he said to his friend, "you can have the whole thing." Wozniak, however, understood better than his father the symbiosis they had. If it had not been for Jobs, he might still be handing out schematics of his boards for free at the back of homebrew meetings. It was Jobs who had turned his ingenious designs into a budding business, just as he had with the Blue Box. He agreed they should remain partners. It was a smart call. To make the Apple II successful required more than just Wozniak's awesome circuit design. It would need to be packaged into a fully integrated consumer product, and that was Jobs's role. He began by asking their erstwhile partner, Ron Wayne, to design a case. I assume they had no money, so I did one that didn't require any tooling and could be fabricated in a standard metal shop, he said. His design called for a plexiglass cover attached by metal straps and a roll-top door that slid down over the keyboard. Jobs didn't like it. He wanted a simple and elegant design, which he hoped would set Apple apart from the other machines with their clunky, gray metal cases. While haunting the appliance aisles at Macy's, he was struck by the Cuisinart food processors and decided that he wanted a sleek case made of light molded plastic. At a homebrew meeting, he offered a local consultant, Jerry Manick, $1,500 to produce such a design. Manick, dubious about Jobs' appearance, asked for the money up front. Jobs refused, but Manick took the job anyway. Within weeks, he had produced a simple, foam-molded plastic case that was uncluttered and exuded friendliness. Jobs was thrilled. Next came the power supply. Digital geeks like Wozniak paid little attention to something so analog and mundane, but Jobs decided it was a key component. In particular, he wanted, as he would his entire career, to provide power in a way that avoided the need for a fan. Fans inside computers were not zen-like. They distracted. He dropped by Atari to consult with Alcorn, who knew old-fashioned electrical engineering. Al turned me on to this brilliant guy named Rod Holt, who was a chain-smoking Marxist who had been through many marriages and was an expert on everything, Jobs recalled. Like Manick and others meeting Jobs for the first time, Holt took a look at him and was skeptical. "I'm expensive," Holt said. Jobs sensed he was worth it and said that cost was no problem. "He just conned me into working," said Holt, who ended up joining Apple full-time. Instead of a conventional linear power supply, Holt built one like those used in oscilloscopes. It switched the power on and off not 60 times per second, but thousands of times. This allowed it to store the power for far less time and thus throw off less heat. That switching power supply was as revolutionary as the Apple II logic board was, Jobs later said. Rod doesn't get a lot of credit for this in the history books, but he should. Every computer now uses switching power supplies, and they all rip off Rod's design. For all of Wozniak's brilliance, this was not something he could have done. "I only knew vaguely what a switching power supply was," Woz admitted. Jobs's father had once taught him that a drive for perfection meant caring about the craftsmanship even of the parts unseen. Jobs applied that to the layout of the circuit board inside the Apple II. He rejected the initial design because the lines were not straight enough. This passion for perfection led him to indulge his instinct to control. Most hackers and hobbyists like to customize, modify, and jack various things into their computers. To Jobs, this was a threat to a seamless end-to-end user experience. Wozniak, a hacker at heart, disagreed. He wanted to include 8 slots on the Apple II for users to insert whatever smaller circuit boards and peripherals they might want. Jobs insisted there be only 2, for a printer and a modem. "Usually I'm really easy to get along with, but this time I told him, if that's what you want, go get yourself another computer," Wozniak recalled. "I knew that people like me would eventually come up with things to add to any computer." Wozniak won the argument that time, but he could sense his power waning. I was in a position to do that then. I wouldn't always be.